Here's how to play Sip, Peel, Win at Dunkin'. Just sip, peel, win.
I want a doormat.
Look more closely.
I want a dog mat?
Put on your reading glasses.
I want a donut.
There you go. Enjoy a large or extra large coffee for your chance to win from millions of prizes, like JetBlue travel certificates, Fandango movie tickets, or Fanatics gear. Just sip, peel, win at Dunkin'. America runs on Dunkin'. No purchase necessary. 13 plus ends 10/15/18 or while supplies last. For game, peace, and official rules, visit sippeelwin.com.
Take the bass line out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectaculario, ripper good bloke, officially a lawyer, Esquire, co-host, Andrew D. Bailey, Esquire. The Esquire came too soon, but let's congratulate Andy for officially passing his bar exam like I told him he would, even though he never believes me because he's a hater.
I didn't believe anyone, so you're not alone there.
All right, that makes me feel a little bit better. But if anyone's interested, I'm not important enough in Andy's life to get a text message that he passed the bar, even though we talk about it ad nauseum. I found out on Twitter, just like the rest of you, and then I angrily texted him and made the situation about me because that's how I roll. We're going to do our Southwest division preview today. Before we get started, just want to remind, implore, beg, plead with everyone to continue rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us on iTunes. If you're looking to get Andy a gift for him officially passing his bar, if you haven't gotten him a gift from when he graduated law school, please, all he wants is just you to throw us a 5-star review. And then also write about us on the iTunes thing. Take the 10 to 15 seconds out of your day, search Hardwood Knox on iTunes, click that 5-star rating, and if you have any reviews or feedback or just want to tell us how awesome we are, please remember to leave comments. We can also be found wherever you listen to your podcast, but iTunes is the best way to help the pod as of now. You can also still get 15% off at the MBA Math Shop. That's mbamath.com/shop, promo code Benno. B-E-N-O. And now we get to the question that matters doubly today. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. What an intro. I second that intro in that an excellent graduation/bar pass gift for me would just be that review on iTunes. That would be fantastic. I'm doing good. Yesterday was a relief. I was telling Dan before we started recording that I don't know if this is the same in every state, but in Wyoming, if you pass, they call you, and if you fail, they send you a letter, which almost seems kind of cruel to me. And because of like a technicality in my application, I had to wait a week longer than most of my classmates too. So the last week has been interesting, but I finally got the call, and now I can breathe a little bit.
That's still just unbelievable torture.
Yeah, I mean, 2 months of preparation for that test that the 3 years of law school didn't accomplish, and then a month of just waiting. And it was, it's nice that it's all over. Kind of crazy to think that I'm now an adult, though. So that'll be fun. I'm in my 30s, and I now have to start adulthood.
You don't ever have to start adulthood.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
So just remember that. We will get to the Southwest division now, though. We are going to go in order of decreasing record like we did for the – what did we do? It was the Northwest division. That means we are starting with the Houston Rockets. Their vitals last year per Cleaning the Glass, they were first in net rating, first in offensive rating, and sixth in defensive rating. What was their best offseason move, Andrew D. Bailey, Esquire?
I'm going to go with re-signing Chris Paul. I was just sort of scanning over their offseason, and it's going to actually be somewhat difficult for me to pick a worst offseason move just because it was and I think my summary on that is just going to be, and I think I used this same term last episode, is anti-Morey. It was just an odd summer. And the Chris Paul deal, I get a lot of people's concerns that he's going to be pretty old by the time that deal is up. And I think that's a valid concern, but I think he's got a year or two, maybe even 2 or 3 years at a really high level still in him. He just finished this season as the number one player in the NBA in real plus minus, which was, you know, when he finally took that spot towards the end of the season, it was kind of surprising because LeBron James and James Harden were both obviously insane all season long, but he's clearly still having a huge impact on the Rockets. And if he's even, you know, 75% of what he was last season, he's going to be really, really, really important to that team. That's a triple, really. Concerns with that are fair, but I still think in when you look at that entire Rockets offseason as a whole, that's probably the most positive move to me.
Chris Paul, it was just the move they had to make.
And that's true.
And I don't think it's a bad move. I just think it's the move you had to make. That contract, years one and two should be fine. It's going to be insanely interesting to see how that ages beyond that second year. For me, their best move was just picking up James Ennis. I thought he would have more of a market in a league. Yes, there wasn't a lot of cap space, but we're talking about a wing who can defend twos and threes and some fours. I expect him to maybe get some power forward minutes with the Rockets. And I know we saw his three-point percentage dip below 35% last year. To pick up someone, though, like him, at the minimum, was just huge to me. And I think he's going to be an excellent fit alongside Chris Paul and James Harden. The Rockets generated wide open 3-point attempts with more frequency last year than any other team. I'm not even talking just raw volume, but the percent of their 3-point attempts, they had the largest wide open share in the league. And James Ennis is going to benefit from that. He doesn't take a ton of shots off the dribble, isn't tempted to take these long twos. When he does put the ball on the floor, he tries to get to the rim or dump the ball off quickly. And I think that's just going to be great for the Rockets. It probably is, and this will dovetail with the next category or overlap with it. It probably does seem even bigger to me just because they lost Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute. So to get someone like him, again, at the minimum, who you can look at and believe will give you, what, 75% of what Trevor Ariza maybe did? I know he was really important to what they did defensively at points. But to get someone like that at the minimum when Trevor Ariza is making $15 million next year, that's a great get by the Rockets.
Yeah, and like you said, that does lead kind of well into biggest loss or worst offseason move. In addition to losing Bamute and Ariza, which you just mentioned, here are the players they added this summer, and each one individually just seems like something, with the exception of the guy that you just described, James Ennis. Each one of these guys just seems like kind of an odd pickup in isolation for Daryl Morey. Brandon Knight, Michael Carter Williams, Carmelo Anthony. Is that it? I feel like there was more. Oh, Marquese Chris. That's who I was missing. Put it all together, I don't know if it makes any more sense than each of those names in isolation. I mean, there's so many issues with every single one of those players. I ended up going with Carmelo Anthony as their worst offseason move, and I think there's reason to think it could work. And if you're looking for those reasons, Dan wrote a good piece about it for NBA Math. I think that was about as good an explanation as anyone's given for that move. But I still have just – I've kind of settled into this spot with Melo in the last 2 or 3 years where I'm just not sure how much he helps good teams. He was really good on that Knicks team that won in the mid-50s a few years ago, had a mid-50s win total. And I think one of those Nuggets teams was really good with him in Chauncey Billups. But other than that, I'm just not sure he's helped a ton of really good winning teams over his career. And last year he actively hurt the Thunder at least statistically. So it's an interesting experiment. I get the play from just like a talent standpoint, but it's still, I think it's going to be a big, big gamble that they're taking here.
It's telltale of their offseason that you went the worst move route rather than the biggest loss, which is just, yeah. the Rockets are just,
because they had big losses too.
Yeah, but they're just wild because I think they've become a bit overrated, but I don't see how they're going to be better, as good, or as big of a threat to the Warriors as last year. We'll see if they prove me wrong or us wrong there, since I think we're kind of in lockstep on that thought. I would say it's really tough for me to say the worst offseason move is signing someone on a minimum deal. And that's where the Carmelo Anthony thing is a risk, but at the minimum, it's not like they're paying him what the Thunder were paying him.
That's true.
And yeah, so it's a minimal risk to me. I think their biggest loss is going to be Luke Bamute. And I think that because he couldn't hit anything during the playoffs. And maybe the Rockets have intel on his shoulder that we don't know about, which would explain why they didn't seem like they were very interested in bringing him back. But he's hit his three-pointers at a high enough clip in each of the past two regular seasons. If his shoulder is fine, I think it's warranted that we believe he would do so again because of all the things that Chris Paul and James Harden do. But you look more so at the scope of his defense and who he defends. And he matches up with point guards, shooting guards, small forwards, fours. That's versatility that not even Ariza has. And Ariza saw time against higher profile, explosive wings in higher volume. I understand that. But Bamute is someone who makes it easier to hide James Harden because he can take on those smaller guard assignments with the smaller backcourt. And he's also going to make life easier on Chris Paul because maybe you spell Chris Paul from not having to defend some of the top point guards in the league every single possession. You still want Chris Paul on those guys. At the same time, we're talking about Chris Paul entering his age, what is he now, 33 season? And so it's just to have someone like him would have just been so big. And maybe I'm just sort of looking at it through the lens that, hey, you have James Ennis, who should be able to replace more of what Trevor Ariza did defensively than what Luke Bamute brought you on the defensive end.
Yeah, I always remember a regular season game against the Jazz when Bamute just completely neutralized Rudy Gobert. They threw Bamute in at the five, and it just completely discombobulated the Jazz. So his versatility was huge for them. That's going to be really, really hard to replace. That's for sure. And I agree. Their ceiling in terms of how well they match up with the Warriors does, at least right now, seem like it's been lowered a little bit.
And also what Bamute did really well last season in Houston that he never really had the opportunity to do in while he was with the Clippers, he would like put the ball on the floor from the three-point line and dribble in and finish on drives or at the rim. And so he... Again, he shot 50% on drives last year, I believe was the number. I looked this up last night, and I don't know why I didn't bring it up this morning. But it's just he did like a lot of these like really good things during the regular season. And I think we were kind of, or a lot of people were just kind of fooled into thinking he wasn't as valuable as he actually was because of what happened during the playoffs. And so I just think they're going to feel his loss more than Ariza's to me, in large part because of how much respect I have for what James Ennis is going to be able to do to fill the Ariza-sized void. That would bring us to the most likely player to break out on this roster, and it's not DeAnthony Melton anymore. If you want to pick him and just talk about the Suns, that's fine too.
Yeah, he probably would have been my pick. I think James Ennis would be a good pick here, and you have come close to swaying me to that. I mean, he's going to be the starting small forward, I would think. So he's certainly going to have an opportunity. This one was kind of hard to pick too, just because most of these guys have already broken out in some capacity with the exception of maybe James Ennis. I went with a name that I just kind of panned, Marquise Chriss. I don't think he's going to play a ton of minutes, but I think when he's on the floor, if it's for like, you know, even 15 to 20 minutes a game, he's going to get wide open looks at the rim at a rate that he just didn't come close to in Phoenix. The way that if he's willing to, you know, roll hard to the basket, it's Harden and Chris Paul are, to me, two of the best pick and roll point guards in the history of the NBA. To have the luxury of having both of them on the same team is just, it's a dream come true for a big man. I couldn't get over that over the course of the playoffs. It didn't matter which big guy was out there setting the screen. They were almost guaranteed to get a bunch of good looks. And I think that's going to happen with Marquise Chriss. He's super athletic and he's never played with anyone who even approaches the ability of these two guys in the pick and roll. So even if it's a really small role that he plays, if he winds up at some point becoming the backup center, and I'm not sure even that's a given that he'll overtake Nene, but if he does, I think he has a chance to be so much more effective than he was in Phoenix, just because he's got two of the best setup guys that I think we've ever had.
Daryl Morey did say that Chris was underrated the other day. And if he's going to make it work as like this trampoline rim runner, it's going to be in Houston because they just have the space. Like, he's going to have wide open lanes to work as the dive man in the pick and roll. I'm interested to see kind of how you mentioned, though, how much playing time I'll actually get. My pick, I think James Ennis is an interesting pick, but I went with Brandon Knight. He's only 26. He turns 27 in December, and I think we need to remember that. And if he's going to make it work post-injury recovery, I think Houston's a good spot for him. Maybe you can try and groom him as this Eric Gordon light. He's never going to give you the same sort of pizzazz off the dribble. First of all, Eric Gordon seems to be aging in reverse when you look at his athleticism. Yes. And if I was a Pelicans fan, maybe it is killing Pelicans fans to watch this. They have to be a little bit angry. They're just like, Eric Gordon like basically dunked more times last season than he ever did in New Orleans. But we went deeper into this when we did the hour breakdown of that Suns Rockets trade at the end of August. So if you want to hear more about our thoughts on that, go check out that pod. But Brandon Knight shot 51.3% when using between three and six dribbles in 2016-2017. The last year he was remotely healthy. The Rockets have now incorporated a lot of these just these isolation off the dribble plays into their offense, and he's someone who might be able to do that. At the same time, he also shot 37.8% on catch and shoot threes through 2014-2015 and 2015-2016 before that efficiency fell off a cliff in 2016-2017. The extra space he's going to be given in Houston, coupled with having, like you said, two of the best, not just pick and roll playmakers, but arguably just two of the best passers of all time in the NBA with James Harden and Chris Paul. When you look at Chris Paul makes probably more complicated passes. James Harden's cross-court passes aren't insane. They're both just super accurate and on point. That should help him out. And I look at his age and that he doesn't turn 27 to December. If he's healthy and can play and the Rockets don't plan on waving him and stretching him and trying to move him, he's someone who I think could make a sneaky impact on this team.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And people do want to hear our 1 hour take on the Rockets Suns trade. There's no question about that.
That was both impressive and pathetic that we went so long on that trade.
I'm going with 100% impressive.
player most likely to be traded on the Rockets this season.
I went with Eric Gordon. I don't think they're going to make a trade. The roster seems pretty set, but if I had to pick one guy who looks like he has a movable deal right now, I would go with Gordon. I don't think they will. He's been so important to them for the last however long he's been there. So I don't see how it would really benefit them. He's got a somewhat movable deal, but I don't think it's good enough value to bring back anyone who's going to help them more than he does, if that makes sense.
You know that Tibbs would take PJ Tucker, Eric Gordon, a first round pick for Jimmy Butler.
Well, you know, that's certainly there. You can't rule anything out when Tibbs is in the equation.
I'm kind of with you there. I don't see an obvious option for this team. Again, I don't think you get rid of PJ Tucker unless it's in a trade to get a star, and they just don't have the assets to get a star right now. That said, Maury was speaking with reporters, I think the day before we were recording this, and he said that they do have their first-round pick, so they have some flexibility. This team is always looking to make moves, so it wouldn't surprise me if they did something. But they're now just, they don't have like great salary fodder. Eric Gordon is probably the closest they come. Maybe Brandon Knight becomes a little bit more valuable over the summer as an expiring deal. Ditto for Gordon, but he would be my pick if they're going to do anything. But I don't really know what the target would be at this point. I might even be inclined just to say Brandon Knight, because maybe this is you bite the bullet and you eventually make the deal for Kent Bazemore at midseason or something. And so one of those two guys for me, that would be my pick. That brings us to better defense or offense for this team, which I think is fairly simple.
Yeah. Last year, like you said, first in offense, sixth in defense. Yep. And they lost two of their main defensive players in Ariza and Mbamute. They added Melo, Brandon Knight, Marquise Chris. I think it's pretty clearly going to be offense again.
Oh, it has to be offense. It has to be. If it's not, something has gone terribly wrong. Like the Melo addition, the Brandon Knight addition, they're getting too many minutes and they're just kind of screwing everything up. So it has to be offense. Do you think they're going to have the best offense in the NBA again?
I do not.
Same.
They'll be up there. I think it'll be kind of like a three-horse race between them, the Warriors, and the Nuggets. Those are my top offenses this season.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Another easy one, playoffs or nah?
Yes, very easy. You were right. They're making it again.
What is their ceiling?
I kind of waffled on this a little bit as I was looking at it. But I ended up going with Western Conference Finals because, like we've both said now, I don't think they are as real a challenge to the Warriors as they were last year. So I think their ceiling is now capped at Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, I'm basically with you there. I don't see a scenario in which they beat the Warriors four times in seven tries. There's still playoff formalities. They might contend for the number two spot in the Western Conference, but I could also see them not finishing in the top two as well. If they're going to beat the Warriors, it would be a war of firepower, and I don't think that Houston has enough of it if we're just relying solely on offense.
Yeah, I totally agree. And they just don't have the same level of defensive versatility that they had last year.
It doesn't seem. Watch them be like third in defense or something.
I know. I meant to say, like, when I was going through these questions last night, I thought I need to mention a couple times that I've just, you never know with Daryl Morey. Like, it seems like he's taken these moves that a lot of people consider to be gambles in the past, and he's been right. But I was pretty much with him in regards to James Harden being a point guard and James Harden being able to play with Chris Paul. This is the first year where I'm like, yeah, you can't even sell that to me. I just don't get it. So it'll be really interesting to see how this team comes together over the course of the season.
The only thing I can really say there is that, and I've cited this stat a zillion times, but per Clean the Glass, when they played with Ariza and Mbamute compared to without them, it only changed their defensive rating by about a point per 100 possession. And maybe there's something there, but I think the fact that you can't have either one of them on the court for the entire season could end up being something that does them in. But hey, you never know.
Yeah.
That brings us to the Pelicans. Their vitals per Cleaning the Glass. They finished 11th in net rating, 11th in offensive rating, and 11th in defensive rating.
Wow.
That's clean. I know, yeah. NBA.com's rankings are going to vary, but how's that for symmetry?
Yeah, that's amazing. This team is super interesting to me. I'm going to be paying very close attention to them at the start of the season.
Does that have anything to do with Anthony Davis firing his agent?
Didn't he hire Clutch too?
That was the rumored favorite. I don't know if it was. I don't think. It was
Made so official. He hasn't made that decision yet.
What's the best offseason move for them?
Julius Randle seems like an obvious call to me. He averaged as a starter last year 19 points, 9 rebounds, and 3 assists. And I think maybe even more important than just those raw numbers is he's clearly a power forward, which means Anthony Davis from day one is clearly going to be a center this year. And I think him at center unlocks things for the Pelicans that him at power forward just doesn't quite get to. He played, these are NBA.com numbers, he played 763 minutes. This is Anthony Davis with no other centers on the floor last season. And in those minutes, he averaged 30.1 points, 12.3 rebounds, 3.2 blocks, 2.4 steals, 1.9 assists per 36 minutes, had a true shooting percentage barely below 60, and the team had a 5.5 net rating in those minutes. And their net rating with Davis and Cousins on the floor was 4.2. And then this is a number that I've cited a bunch of times on the pod. When it was Davis and Mirotić together, the net rating was actually north of 10. So I think Davis at center clearly works. And I think also when he's playing center is when Alvin Gentry he started to revert back to that Phoenix Sun style, where it was just run. And they were an offensive monster once they sort of flipped that switch. So, and I think they're going to play that way all season with Julius Randle at the four. And they're really, really, really interesting to me. So I'm going to go with Julius Randle, even though I probably talked more about Anthony Davis in that little segment.
My one concern is there are probably going to be minutes where they play all three of them together, and I just Mirotić, Randle, and Davis.
Yeah, that's kind of funky. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just a little interested to see how that goes. But I think you're right, because you look at it, if things do, you try it out. You have to try it out. You just have to. And if it goes belly up, then you go to greater lengths to stagger minutes. And like you said, it just means that Davis is clearly a five, and that really helps you. The thing with Davis, the five, by the way, this is for the entire season. And so we're taking in minutes where Mirotić wasn't there. The Pelicans, when Ian Clark was off the court and Davis was at center, for the season per Cleaning the Glass, plus 5.9 points per 100 possessions. So that's for the entire season. Like, it's not even just post the Mirotić trade. Having Davis at center is just a veritable cheat code for them at this point. But I have nothing really to add with Randle. I'm interested to see how he'll do sort of jump-starting the offense when Davis is on the bench, and just, you know, giving him that freedom to just get up and down the court. Him leading second units could get incredibly interesting there. I don't really know that there's another pick for this team, though, for the best offseason move, just unless you're super high on Elfrid Payton or Jahlil Okafor still.
Yeah, and those would both be interesting guys to be super high on, although I think I'm one of the only remaining survivors of Elfrid Payton Island at this point.
I can't confirm.
The 4-5 pick and rolls with Randle and Davis, too. Assuming they run some of those, and I hope they do. Those should be fun.
What was the biggest loss or worst offseason move for the Pelicans? Or move they didn't make, if you don't think that one qualifies.
Yeah. I'm going worst offseason move route again. And this is much like Melo. It's, you know, financially not a huge risk. And maybe Jahlil Okafor just ends up being a training camp deal. I mean, there's a chance he doesn't even make the regular season roster. So this all could be this whole discussion could be moot in a few weeks. But I'm going to go with Jahlil Okafor just because I don't see how he helps many NBA teams at this point. And I'd rather see Cheick Diallo just be the clear backup five on this team. I think he has some potential as a rim runner. He tops Okafor in basically every catch-all, although not by a ton in a couple of them. But yeah, I'm going to go with Jahlil Okafor. But like you said, I might have even been better off searching for a move that they should have made, because this was kind of a tough one to pick.
Yeah, I went with a move that they should have made type deal, and they needed more help on the wings to me.
Yeah.
And someone who can just defend and shoot. Those players do not grow on trees. They did not have cap space. But to me, it's kind of fair to wonder if they could have used their Julius Randle money on that type of player, and maybe the roster looks better for it. Because they don't really need another big. You have Mirotić, who's not a three, and you have Anthony Davis, who is a five. And so it seems like that could have worked out there. The problem with thinking that way, of course, is who do they sign with that money? Because, yes, you probably could have gotten a Marco Bellinelli, but the Spurs overpaid him, and he's not someone who's just going to move your needle a ton. James Ennis, look at what he ended up signing for in Houston. They didn't wait that long to see how the market developed, but that would have been someone who could have been interesting in New Orleans. And so they did try. They did throw that offer sheet at Tyrone Wallace. A lot of people didn't think that the Clippers were going to match. And so it's not like they didn't have that in their head. And again, it's easier for me to sit there and say this. They weren't going to go after someone like Tyreke Evans, who's not really 3 and D anyway. They already did that experience, done and over with. I just kind of wonder if they should have looked harder at allocating that Julius Randle money, that mid-level exception money, to a wing who could shoot or at least really switch defensively. And that really would have made their roster more intriguing to me than it is now.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you could say that pretty much every team in the NBA could use some more wings. So
Nwaba would have been nice there. Don't know what goes on behind the scenes, and Julius Randle it's interesting that I'm saying he was their best move, but their worst move was not using that money on a wing. I understand that there's a level of hypocrisy there, but they definitely needed insofar as not every team desperately needs a wing, they definitely needed one more than I would say 2/3 of the league.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Most player most likely to break out for the Pelicans.
I'm going with rookie of the year candidate Frank Jackson, even though he's probably not much of a rookie of the year candidate. But I kind of liked him coming out of Duke. I thought he made a lot of sense for last year's Pelicans team. So it was kind of a bummer that he got hurt and missed the entire season. He is maybe he's a little bit of the wing help that they need. I know he's seen more as a point guard, and he's probably too short. In fact, he is too short to guard a lot of wings in the NBA, but he played kind of like a wing, at least offensively at Duke. He averaged 19 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists, and almost 3 threes per 75 possessions at Duke. Shot almost 40% from 3, almost 60 true shooting percentage. He was just a really, really solid player for them, I thought. So I think he could be interesting for some backcourt depth for the Pelicans this season. They already have a very small wing rotation when they start Peyton, Holiday, and Moore 1 through 3, and Frank Jackson kind of adds to that. But I think he's an interesting addition to that backcourt/wing rotation that they've already got.
I'm with you. I don't really think there is another pick. I'm tempted to go with Darius Miller. Maybe he makes more strides at the defensive end this year, and he shot the 3-ball extremely well last season, and I really like him. And he's, when you look at kind of the help that they need on the wings, he's probably the closest to an in-house solution that they're going to come, and unless you believe that Frank Jackson's going to be able to play up defensively. When Nikola Mirotić, Darius Miller, and Anthony Davis shared the floor last season per Cleaning the Glass, the Pelicans outscored opponents by 16.2 points per 100 possessions.
Name those three guys again.
Anthony Davis, if I misspoke, I apologize. Nikola Mirotić and Darius Miller.
Okay.
117.8 offensive rating, 101.6 defensive rating. That's a terrifying number. Sample size wasn't especially huge. A lot of those minutes, possessions came with Rondo, and that could be something to watch. But I would think a lineup that I really just want to see a ton of is Drew Holiday, Etwan Moore, Darius Miller, Mirotić, and Anthony Davis. And I think that could wind up being, or should wind up being, the Pelicans' best lineup of the year.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. And just for the sake of clarification, Frank Jackson measured 6'4". So he's right in line with like Drew Holiday and Etwan Moore, another undersized wing for the Pelicans.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call him a wing. I'd call him a guard. But
yeah, that's probably fair.
He should help their shooting. Darius Miller, we do have to watch and see whether he can replicate his 3-point performance from last year. 41.1% on 6.6 attempts per 36 minutes is just, that's more than dependable. That's just outrageously good. And he shot the three ball well in the past once, 2012-2013, also in New Orleans, but it was just never on that type of volume. And we'll have to see whether he gives an encore, but I think that he could be a part of some of their best lineups. Like you said, though, I think the pick is Frank Jackson, player most likely to be traded on this roster.
Another team I just don't think is going to make a trade, but I guess if things start rough and then get worse and worse and worse as we approach the trade deadline, it's got to be Anthony Davis, right?
I would disagree, but I'm willing to hear your case.
I'm just thinking, you know, there's been so much smoke around him the last couple years, especially, you know, concerning the Celtics and maybe the Lakers. So if things are going poorly, I could see his name popping up in the rumor mill around the trade deadline. Although I think the Pelicans are going to be pretty good. So I default back to my original statement that I just don't think it's just hard for me to see a marquee trade. Maybe they trade somebody around the edges of the roster, and that wouldn't be super surprising. But just for the sake of keeping it spicy, if things go wrong, I'm going to say Anthony Davis.
Keeping it spicy. I just don't – I don't think you visit the Anthony Davis trade front until next summer. He'll have a year left on his contract. He's not going to sign the designated veteran extension – that's when you look at it. Right now, it's just a non-starter if someone's calling about Anthony Davis. And you know the Rockets will. You know the Celtics will. I would, unless he requests to get out, and I don't think he'll do that unless the Pelicans are really bad. And I guess you can leave that door open. For me, it's Solomon Hill. And here, I know he's not a trade asset. I'm just saying, you look at what he's owed. It's about 2 years and $25 million. Maybe you could flip that into just a more expensive wing. Kent Bazemore would be someone. Maybe you could build a package around that that saves the Hawks some money in the final year of that deal. That would just be something to watch. And they're a team that I expect to be aggressive in any way that they can because they know that Anthony Davis's free agency is coming up. And you want to point to him and say, look, we have a good team in place. Like, we're ready to do this. Going after a more expensive player, an overpaid one, which is kind of their, I don't want to say their ceiling in trade talks, but that would be their best way to get an impact addition, would be to take on that player who is overpaid. That does then compromise their cap situation for next summer, which actually looks pretty rosy if you expect Julius Randle to decline his $9.1 million player option. But I do think they'll have to be aggressive because you are on the clock with Anthony Davis. I don't think you need to move him this year, even think about moving him, but you do need to really just impress upon him how close you are to competing in the Western Conference.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense. I just I wonder how much trade value Solomon Hill has, but like you said, if it's a deal that saves a team money, then that certainly adds value to that equation.
Yeah, and there's, you know, they have some expiring deals with Ajinsa and even Elfrid Payton, and maybe there's stuff that could be worked there. But I would be stunned if Anthony Davis was moved before the trade deadline.
Oh, it would be surprising. And like I said, I don't think they're going to make a deal. It just to me, that was interesting.
Better defense or offense for the Pelicans?
They were 11th in both according to Cleaning Glass, right?
Yep.
I'm going to say offense. like I said earlier, I think with Davis at the five all season, and I think if they play that that Alvin Gentry style all season, I think their offense is definitely going to be better.
Yeah, you don't sign Julius Randle with the intention of making your defense better. And he improved in some areas defensively last year, but if you're going to play at that type of pace and you're looking at the personnel they have, they just don't have a bunch of these great stopping power wings. And so I think it's going to be the offense for them as well. Playoffs or nah?
I'm going with yes.
I would go with yes as well. What do you have their ceiling as?
I'm going to say second round. I'm tempted to list like 6 or 7 teams as potential Western Conference finalists.
Right now, the question is if you can avoid the Warriors in the first two rounds, that gives you a chance in the Western Conference finals.
Yeah, that's true. But I think this is a team that if they run up against, I don't think they can beat Houston or Utah in the second round, maybe even OKC. I think their ceiling is maybe slightly lower than.
I think that's fair, and I would probably agree with you. I might be more worried about how they match up with Utah and Oklahoma City at this point than Houston, which maybe that'll look crazy by the end of the season. That brings us to the San Antonio Spurs, who did absolutely nothing this offseason. So maybe we can even talk about them. Per Clean the Glass, 9th in net rating, 17th in offense, 4th in defensive rating. What was their best offseason move, Andy?
I use this word a bunch in the Northwest preview, but I'm going to say DeMar DeRozan by default. Trading DeMar DeRozan for Kawhi Leonard in a vacuum seems like a Spurs loss, but I get why they did it. I do think he's a pretty solid player. That little thing I do at the end of every season where I average the rankings of players in like 7 different catch-all metrics, DeMar DeRozan wound up 26th in that. So he's a really good player. And the thing a lot of people have said is you're adding DeMar DeRozan to a 47-win team, which I don't think tells the whole story because that omits the fact that Kyle Anderson and Danny Green aren't there anymore. So I don't know if the Spurs, in fact, I don't think the Spurs got better this offseason, but of all the moves that they made, DeMar DeRozan looks like the most positive addition to me.
Yeah, it's so tough to it's just so weird because DeMar DeRozan's a great player. Just when you're giving up Kawhi Leonard, the package they got to me was just blah. And
it's a tough argument to make, that's for sure.
I went with and this was sort of a default move to me. I went with re-signing Davis Bertans. 2 years, $14 million, probably an overpay, but the length makes it very digestible. He is their path to coming somewhat close to modernizing the front court. And I looked this up.
I love fans, by the way.
Yeah, and he's going to space the floor, which is something that LaMarcus Aldridge can do sort of, but not conventionally, because he's not going to take a bunch of three-pointers in volume. And you look at Bertans, and he can be that guy. And I also looked this up, which could get interesting. It depends on how much they want to play Jakob Poeltl and Pau Gasol. But in the time that Bertans and Aldridge played last year without Kawhi, Kyle Anderson, and Danny Green, the Spurs were plus 10.4 points per 100 possessions with an offensive rating of 115.1. The significance of that, even in a small sample size, is that the Spurs' offense was just not great last year. It was good when LaMarcus Aldridge was on the floor, but it still wasn't great. And to have an offensive rating in the 93rd percentile for any remote stretch that spanned more than 250 possessions, I think is a pretty substantial accomplishment for them. And they're going to need Bertans more than ever when you look at just some of their most important players right now. I mean, we went through this in the previous pod. Their projected starting lineup hit 205 threes last year combined. Joe Ingles at 204 himself. So yeah, you need to provide that spacing. And maybe they get to a point where they start Bertans and bring Pau Gasol off the bench. That it might all just depend how invested they are in Jakob Poeltl.
Yeah, I'm with all that. I love Bertans. The way he shoots is just he has one of those shooting forms that just is almost mesmerizing.
Biggest loss or worst offseason move or something that they didn't do that they should have done?
Biggest loss to me was pretty clearly Kyle Anderson. That same little exercise I just talked about with DeRozan, Kyle Anderson wound up 35th in the NBA last season, which I think would be a lot higher than most people would guess for him. I think he was a huge part of their success defensively. He's just an excellent modern four. He doesn't shoot a ton of threes, but he can create from the four, which I think is also pretty valuable nowadays if you can have kind of a point forward at that spot. And he's just he's an advanced stats darling. I think that helped their overall net rating a lot. So it's kind of weird to not say Kawhi Leonard. I just didn't go with him because I don't think they were ever going to bring him back. I think they lost Kawhi Leonard long before this offseason, if that makes sense. So I went with Kyle Anderson.
Yeah, kudos. I don't know if I ever gave you props for that, but you stuck to it, and I was convinced that they weren't going to move him. The closest I came to making a good prediction was that I thought it was going to be to a dark horse if they did. But I was convinced they were going to keep him, just like I was convinced LeBron wasn't going to the Lakers. You also said that he was going there. And Kawhi Leonard is their biggest loss, not up for debate. But there are so many things that just – I'm just even going to list them off and not explain them. You lose Kawhi Leonard. You lose Kawhi Leonard, Kyle Anderson, and Danny Green, three of your four most important defenders in the same damn offseason. Yeah. You overpaid Marco Bellinelli. You didn't get one of the Raptors' three or four best young players in the trade for Kawhi Leonard. I like Jakob Poeltl, but I'd be more interested – All right, they couldn't have traded Van Vliet, but to not get OG Anunoby, who you were probably never going to get given Leonard's contract and health situation, I would have even been more interested in Siakam. I might have been more interested in Dellen Wright. I'm not going to lie there. There's just so much that the Spurs didn't do. To not even get a first-round pick, forget that it's protected. It's protected for a year, and then it turns into two second-round picks. There just seems like there are a lot of missteps in San Antonio's part. Doesn't speak to how I view DeMar DeRozan in a vacuum. I think he is a very good offensive player. And like you've said many times, I think he could end up having a career year with them, particularly on the defensive side. It seems like some of these players just get plugged into San Antonio and they don't look as shitty on defense anymore. But there's a lot to choose from in San Antonio. And so I just look at their offseason in sum as this just weird hedge against trying to avoid a rebuild but not staying in the contender circle. Most likely player to break out on this roster?
I went with DeJounte Murray. He kind of broke out last season, and they basically gave him the point guard position last season. But now Tony Parker's gone, and here comes a patented weird Andy stat. No one in NBA history had a season.
I'm sorry. The preface and then the start was just fantastic.
I was waiting for your reaction. Nobody in NBA history had a season that matched Murray's 2017-18 assist percentage, rebounding percentage, and steal percentage. Now, here's where we're going to get funky. Drop the qualifiers to 20 assist percentage, 10 rebounding percentage, and 2 steal percentage, and the list now has 42 players, which seems like a lot, but only 10 of those guys were shorter than DeJounte Murray. Now, the reason I bring up that seemingly obscure stat is to say that the rest of that list is mostly big guys. And he provides a combination of things that not a lot of guards over the course of NBA history have provided. He's an excellent rebounder from the guard position. And one modifier I didn't even include in that search was blocks. He can block some shots too. He gets steals, he gets assists. He fills up the box score pretty much everywhere but points. If he's even like slightly below average as a scorer this year, I think he could have a huge impact for this team.
And that's what it is for him. He's my pick as well. I also wouldn't be surprised if it's one of Lonnie Walker or Derek White. One of those guys I feel like should end up being in the rotation this year. And it wouldn't surprise me if we looked at them, they're like, oh, the Spurs drafted another gem.
Yeah. Derek White is really interesting to me.
Yeah, after his summer league, Lonnie Walker seems like a fantastic human being, and so I just assume he's going to be good at basketball because of karma. But we'll see. Just with Murray, he needs to be, preferably both, but he needs to be either a threat from three, even as a standstill shooter, or he has to get like this pull-up jumper, even if it's not from beyond the arc. Like, it can be inside the arc. He shot 31% on catch-and-shoot looks last year, 27.3% on spot-up threes, and he shot 33.2% on pull-up jumpers, which actually was higher than I thought that he shot on those. So maybe that's something that's a good harbinger. Those pull-ups accounted for almost a third of his looks, though, and to shoot 33.2% on them is not ideal. And he has he is pretty reliable when you're looking at him around the basket. He shot 58.3% inside of 10 feet last year, and that's where most of his shots are coming from. But you need him to develop a jumper, whether it's a pull-up jumper or just to space the floor as a standstill three-point shooter around LaMarcus Aldridge and DeMar DeRozan, because this team needs floor balance terribly.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Player most likely to be traded.
Again, I don't think the Spurs are going to make a trade this summer, and that's not much of a stretch for the Spurs, because that basically is in-season Spurs trades. But if I had to pick someone, I'm going to say Pau Gasol. He has, I mean, maybe it's just as like the fact that his contract is big enough to be included in a trade. I'm looking up and down the roster, and it's just hard to see, who's going to have value around the league.
Yeah. Maybe Patty Mills's contract still isn't great. He is including next season or this season, whatever you want to call it, 3 years and $37.3 million. I think Gasol's the right choice. Just because he has that partial guarantee next year. And so theoretically he could help a team save money depending on which contract they're sending back to San Antonio. His partial guarantee though is $6.7 million. That's like a player's salary.
Yeah, that's not,
you're taking back a pretty terrible contract for that to make sense, but I'm probably with you there. If it's not him, maybe it's Rudy Gay on the 1 year, $10.1 million. Dollar deal. It's not him though. Maybe it's Poeltl. Like, maybe they're sweetening a deal and they find out that they don't need him. I think Gasol is the pick, but this is probably a team that's not making a move during the middle of the season. If it is, it might be one that leans toward a teardown because they didn't meet expectations or didn't meet their own expectations. Better defense or offense for this team?
Like you said, they lost some really, really important defensive players, probably their three most important defensive players. But the gap between their offense and defense last year was huge. And I'm not sure they got that much, like a whole bunch better offensively either. So I don't think they made up that gap. I think they'll still be better on defense, even though they're not going to be as good league-wide on defense. That's not much of a glowing review, but I think the defense is probably still going to be their bigger strength.
I'm with you there, and maybe the offense is a lot better, but the Spurs just do a fantastic job of controlling the pace and flow of games. 29th in pace last year, and when you're going to play at that speed, it makes it easier for everyone to defend. You still have Murray. LaMarcus Aldridge, if you're going to give him minutes at the five, he can be kind of an underrated defender there. The wing spots are going to be where it gets difficult. Who do you count on there? Is it Rudy Gay, DeRozan, Walker, Bellinelli? Those guys just aren't these defensive whizzes. I still think, though, just because it's the Spurs, that their defense will be better. Again, not a glowing review, but sort of a Spurs or the Spurs type deal. Yeah. Here's an interesting one, though. Playoffs or not for them?
I went with no. I'm sticking with those predictions we made a little while back. I don't think the Spurs and the Blazers are going to make the playoffs of that crazy bloodbath that is like 3 through 10 or whatever it is in the West. I think those are going to be the unfortunate guys who miss, the Spurs and the Blazers.
I'm going to say yes. And I think we do have to give some credit to how much DeRozan will sort of help them. This is a team that won 47 games last year without Kawhi Leonard, and now you're bringing in DeMar DeRozan, who kind of showed for the first time that he can lead lineups without a Kyle Lowry's safety net in Toronto. He played 1,000 possessions without Kyle Lowry last year, and during that time, Toronto was had a plus 9.2 net rating. The defense was not good, that I'll say, 113.4 defensive rating, but the offense was fantastic, offensive rating of nearly 123. I think he's going to help them enough, and I'm low enough on the Timberwolves and skeptical enough on the Blazers that I don't think it'll take much to go right for the Spurs to get into the playoffs. Once they get there, I don't see their ceiling being more than a surprise second-round appearance. And that might even be a stretch, because if they make the playoffs, there's a really good chance it'll be as the 7 or 8 seed, and they don't match up particularly well with the Warriors or the Rockets.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I put first round as their ceiling if they do get in the playoffs, and it's just for that reason.
Now we get to your favorite team, the Dallas Mavericks. I didn't mention these in the vitals. The Rockets were 65-17 last year. The Pelicans were 48-34. The Spurs, as I just said, 47-35. The Mavericks were 24-58. Their vitals per cleaning the glass were, why can't I find them per cleaning the glass? This is awkward. I'm like missing
good ones.
What's that? Well, here they are. They were 22nd. I don't know why I just like couldn't find the DAL. Real life problems going on over here, folks. Dallas, 22nd in net rating, 24th in offensive rating, 16th in defensive rating. What was their best move of the offseason, Andy?
Luka Doncic, the trade to move up and get him. He last year in Europe, EuroLeague and Spanish ACB combined, he averaged 20.3 points, 7.6 rebounds, 6.5 assists, 2.1 threes, 1.6 steals per 36 minutes, had a true shooting percentage near 60. He had a 6.4 box plus minus in EuroLeague and a 7.7 box plus minus in the Spanish ACB. Shout out to Jacob Goldstein for calculating those. Those box plus minuses were second in both the EuroLeague. That EuroLeague BPM was second, and that Spanish ACB box plus minus was second. And those are two leagues that, despite what some egg avies on Twitter will tell you, are just significantly better basketball than the NCAA. I actually asked an NBA player about that this summer. Who's spent time both in the NBA and a lot of time in the EuroLeague. How much better is European competition than the NCAA? And I don't have his answer. I wonder if I can find it really quick. Something about... He thought that the best team in the NCAA would lose to like a middle tier European team by 50 points. I wish I could find his actual answer, but it was basically like it would be a bloodbath. Especially if Real Madrid, which is one of the best teams in Europe, played any of these college teams. It's just not even close, the level of competition. So for him to put up the kind of numbers that I just rattled off at such a high level and at such a young age, this guy is still just 19 years old. I think this was a home run of a move by the Mavericks. I'll nitpick it a little bit later. but just getting Luka Doncic, I think, was huge.
Oh, for sure. The first round pick they gave up makes me a little uneasy, just because we know they had the opportunity to take on Bazemore instead of giving that up. But if they really are low on next year's draft, that pick will probably convey to Atlanta anyway. Doncic is the player that's going to make every team that passed on him look foolish. And I think you can even include the Phoenix Suns in there, who drafted DeAndre Ayton, who is the clear number one to a lot of people, and he should be a fantastic NBA player, moves like a guard on the offensive end. No one's immune from being in that category, though, of just having the buyer's remorse. DeAndre Ayton could be an all-star, same for Trae Young, and both Atlanta/Phoenix could still come to regret that they didn't take Doncic. He just has that transcendent skill set, and you watched more of him than I did. But what I'll say is, to have someone that young look so comfortable hitting these ridiculously tough shots off the dribble, I just don't. And to have the size that he does, so this isn't an undersized Trae Young who was doing it at Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Mind-melting to me. And very clearly their best move of the offseason.
I found that quote. He said, if the top college team played the worst EuroLeague team, the Euro team would win by 55. I mean, they almost beat NBA teams. And I think Real Madrid even did beat OKC in a preseason game a couple years ago. So it's not close.
Worst offseason move, biggest loss, or something that they didn't do that they should have?
So this is what I was hinting at. I think their biggest loss was next year's first round pick. The rumor right before the trade was made that Atlanta wanted to get off of Kent Bazemore's salary. I think Dallas should have just done that deal, especially because they said that one of the reasons they weren't taking on money is because they wanted to compete now or something like that. But I think Bazemore would have helped them compete now. In fact, I think he would have, if he was on that team, he should probably play more than Wesley Matthews. So that part of the deal was a little bit weird to me. If they had the opportunity to get Doncic without giving up a first round pick, I'm still a little confused why they didn't go ahead and do that.
This steps on the toes of your answer. They should have found a way to take a flyer on a wing. And I think that Bazemore would have been that player. Looking at all the injuries that Wesley Matthews has had, Bazemore is probably more valuable to them than Matthews. And he also provides another layer of playmaking that Matthews really doesn't. But even independent of that, you use all of your cap space on the DeAndre Jordan. Like, where were you as like the... It seems like they're trying to win. We saw what James Ennis signed for in Houston. Maybe he was only willing to do that for the Rockets. Where were they on like the Glenn Robinson and the Travion Graham fronts? Just like those type of players. Or David Nwaba. Like those would just to like a cheaper wing. Just someone that they could have gotten. Because it does seem like they need a little bit of help there. Unless they're really still high on Dorian Finney-Smith. And I'm not sure that he's going to ever help them much on the offensive side, but it's the same kind of just steps on the toes of the Bazemore sentiments that you had. Player most likely to break out on the Mavericks.
This is going to be cheap, but I'm going to say Luka Doncic.
That's it. All right. We'll just leave it there. I agree. I think it's most likely to be Doncic. I do worry about how much control over the offense he will have, but Dennis Smith Jr., I think this could be the season where you just look at him, and I know that his numbers were not great last year. His efficiency was just rock bottom level. He also had the seventh highest usage rate in NBA history among rookies, and he showed flashes last year. Was better at finishing around the rim as the season wore on. Does need to kind of hone his jumper in general, but also his pull-up jumper. I see him having the tools, though, to be a lot better defensively this year, and maybe they're going to give him more freedom than they will Doncic. It's kind of neck and neck to me for them, but if Doncic is going to be the better player, I don't know who will be better next year, but those two guys, they have, and that says a lot about maybe the Mavericks straddling this line between rebuilding and competing. They have two guys that I think have legitimate cases for monster breakouts next season.
Yeah, I'm totally fine with picking Dennis Smith there. He showed some things in the second half of last season that were, I think, certainly encouraging.
Player most likely to be traded on the Mavericks.
This was another tough one. I went with Wesley Matthews just because he's an expiring contract, and I look up and down that roster, and again, it's hard to see like super movable deals.
Yeah, he'd probably be my pick too. I don't know what you turn him into because they're clearly reluctant about jeopardizing their cap space for 2019. So, but yeah, he would definitely be the most likely option. The note I will add, and I know that DeAndre Jordan wasn't necessarily a bad pickup. You didn't need to spend all your cap space on DeAndre Jordan, in my mind. It helps to kind of have Dirk works best as a center, it seems like, but you kind of also need like this big man buffer to protect the rim when he's on the floor. It just seems like couldn't have Ed Davis have done like a lot of what DeAndre Jordan's going to bring to the table for much cheaper, and then that would have given you money to spend on the wing. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but that was just the point I wanted to make.
I think DeAndre Jordan is still really good, but I never thought about I think Ed Davis is pretty underrated. That was a steal by the Nets.
Yeah, that was that Ed Davis and Travion Graham. They had a heck of an off season.
Sean Marks.
Yeah, and just for Dennis Smith Jr., the number that I wanted to bring up, he shot 63% inside of 5 feet after the All-Star break, 60% inside of 8 feet after the All-Star break, 64.5% inside the restricted area after the All-Star break, and he got to the rim pretty readily, and that's why there's a recipe for him to have to take some major strides forward. I want to see a lot of minutes with both him and Doncic on the floor, though, and I'm hoping the Mavericks don't curtail that because they're too worried about winning. Better defense or offense for this team?
I'm going to piggyback your Smith comment real quick first. From March 1st to the end of the season, it was only 15 games, but he averaged 17 points, 7 assists, 3 rebounds, 42% from the field, and 34 from 3. So there's certainly reason for optimism for him. I went with I think their offense will get better, but I think this is a team that's just coached in a way like the Spurs, where the defense is just going to be solid by virtue of the fact that it's the Mavericks and Rick Carlisle, which is kind of funny because 10 years ago it was offense as soon as you're talking about the Mavericks. So I'm going to go with defense, but not by a lot.
I think it might actually be defense by a fair margin. Doncic is going to help their offense, and maybe having a rim runner like Jordan will help them offensively too. And Dirk is just fantastic when you look at how he stretches defenses wafer thin. But it's like you said, they're well coached. I think you look at their defensive rating every year and you find, or from last year, and the fact that they were average despite only winning 24 games is pretty incredible. And you just look at they were fifth in defense in points allowed per 100 possessions after committing a turnover last year per cleaning the glass. And that's like, to have a team that is just going to get back, they were ninth in defensive efficiency off of live rebounds per cleaning the glass. They're a team that's just going to get back. Harrison Barnes remains an underrated defender. I think Dennis Smith Jr. is eventually going to be good at that end. Maybe it's this season. Wesley Matthews is a bit of a wild card after his latest injury, but he's always kind of hustled at that end. And Jordan, he should help kind of the center spot. And he's another big who, like Dwight Powell, is going to help make sure that you do a fairly good job on the defensive glass. Or they'll box out guys so that Dirk Nowitzki can clean up a lot on the defensive glass. I don't know where they'll end up ranking, but they have a better chance to me of having a top 10 defense than a top 10 offense.
Totally true.
Playoffs or not for them?
I'm going with no. Although as you've given me a hard time a couple times, I still think they can approach 40 wins. Like,
wow.
Battle for 500 record. So even then they're not going to make the playoffs.
That's their ceiling for you, is the 40 wins or 500 record.
Yeah. I will say 42 wins is their ceiling, which is – that's pretty high considering they just won 24.
I'm going to say playoffs not, and I'll give them 35 to 37 win ceiling. I just don't – I don't know how you talk yourself in. Maybe I'm wrong, but if Doncic just comes on and he's like a better shooting version of Ben Simmons or something,
Here's my thing. I think Rick Carlisle is he's at least top five, and I think you could probably make an argument he's even better than that as a coach. They had a couple of lineups last year that were excellent, like that super small lineup we've detailed a few times on the podcast with Barea, Devin Harris, and who am I missing? There was one other guard in there. It'll come to me later. That lineup was really, really good, and I think if they have the directive to be competitive this year, I think they could be a really tough out for a lot of teams. So I'm just kind of defaulting to Rick Carlisle on this, and the fact that he has a little bit more talent to work with now. And if they're actively trying to win games, which I don't think they were for basically all of last season, this is going to be it's just going to look like a much different team. And having said all that, I still don't think there's any chance they make the playoffs.
Brings us to the final team in the Southwest Division. The Memphis Grizzlies, not sure how much their 2017-2018 finals matter, because talk about a tag job.
Yeah.
26th in net rating, 27th in offensive rating, 24th in defensive rating, all per cleaning the glass. They did a fair amount this offseason. What was your favorite move for them, Andy?
Best addition for me was Jaren Jackson. These are the College Basketball Reference has only tracked box plus minus since the 2010-11 season. So this is pretty limited sample, but if you just look at freshmen who played 500 minutes, at least 500 minutes, here's the top five in box plus minus. 1, Anthony Davis. 2, Karl Anthony Towns. 3, Jaren Jackson Jr. 4, Joel Embiid. 5, Nerlens Noel.
That is a Stazats tweet.
He was a monster on like a per minute basis last season. He looked ridiculous in summer league. He was just eye popping in Salt Lake. I think he's going to be really, really good. To me, he was the number two prospect behind Luka Doncic in this draft. So to get him where they got him was kind of a coup by the Grizzlies. I think that's clearly their best offseason move.
Same. And I think he was the number two prospect in the draft as well. I worry about how much freedom he's going to get in Memphis, though, just because you look at having now Kyle Anderson's going to take over some of the ball handling responsibilities. You have Mike Conley, you have Marc Gasol. How much are they going to play him? Have we seen anything on whether he's going to start? Do they still consider Jamichael Green their starting four? And when you look at what he did in summer league, I don't just want to see him spotting up from beyond the arc and playing defense and crashing glass. I want to see him with the ball in his hands. When you look at what he was able to do in summer league, this is a guy who should be a very efficient, very exciting playmaker off the dribble. And I'm hoping, I understand that the Grizzlies are they're trying to win, but they need to find room to let him grow. They need to give him a long leash. And I'm hoping that they do just that. He just seems like he checks every single box that you want in today's NBA. He's like a big who plays like a wing, which is like you want that size. And it's not even like a Kristaps Porzingis or a Karl Anthony Towns or a Miles Turner. He's closer to just Anthony Davis on that level with just more off the dribble vision. And that's not saying he's going to be better than Anthony Davis. That's like the archetype. And to not give that player free reign would just be brain bending to me.
Yeah. If they don't start that way, I hope they eventually find plenty of minutes for him.
Well, there's going to be a point, spoiler, that they're going to realize that they're not making the playoffs probably. Yeah. And maybe that's when it turns. Biggest lost or worst offseason move or something that they didn't do that you wish they did?
I'm going to backpedal real quick. That Mavericks lineup that I was referencing, it was their second most used lineup last season. J.J. Barea, Yogi Ferrell is the guy I couldn't remember, and Devin Harris were 1 through 3.
It's just anyone who goes to the Kings you instantly forget about. Carry on.
That's that Lion King meme, that shadowy area we don't go to. That lineup, Barea, Ferrell, Harris, Nowitzki, Powell, almost had a 20 net rating, and it was their second most used lineup. So I think the Mavericks will be slightly unleashed. Now, back on track. Biggest loss for the Grizzlies, I went with Tyreke Evans. I get why they had to move on from him, but just looking at last season alone, the Grizzlies had a plus 0.3 net rating when Tyreke Evans was on the floor. As bad as they were still positive with Evans on the floor. And when he was off, they were minus 11.2, which is just a huge swing. Again, I get why they had to move on, but if we're just looking at like the impact it's going to have on them as a basketball team, losing Tyreke Evans certainly hurt.
And if you weren't going to re-sign him or knew that he was going to get that just inflated one-year offer, seriously, why didn't you trade him?
Yep.
Insane to me. And maybe Mike Conley's return complicates things because it's someone else who has the ball, but I'm excited to see Evans play with Victor Oladipo. And I don't think that, you know, Mike Conley's probably more accustomed to playing off the ball at this point than Oladipo, or at least just as. And it could have worked. And you gave up someone who shot almost 40% from three. He probably won't replicate his success off the dribble from last year. I think he hit like 37% of his pull-up threes. I'll have to double-check that, but you should have moved him if you had the sense that that could sort of happen. And even if you don't want to blame them for it, if it's just something, oh, they didn't trade him because they thought they were going to be able to keep him and they didn't, that's a big loss. And he shot 40.8% on 3.3 pull-up attempts per game last season, Tyreke Evans. That's nuts.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
What's the it'll help with Kyle Anderson, because with Evans gone, now you do have Anderson takes over the playmaking, but just the floor spacing, the speed even, and the ability to really pull up off the dribble. Maybe a lot of people will trust Anderson's kind of floater mid-range game fine, but then you lose that floor spacing element for now. You probably gain some things defensively. So maybe it's more of a lateral move or perhaps just a better fit than we think, but I think Evans was the cleaner fit for Memphis than Anderson. Most likely player to break out on this roster.
I'm going with Jaren Jackson. Again, I'm not going to be quite as short as I was with the Luka Doncic breakout. Just because while you were talking about Kyle Anderson, I just randomly thought Kyle Anderson, Jaren Jackson, 4 or 5 minutes could be really interesting for them. So, yeah, 4 or 5 pick and rolls with those two. That's very intriguing to me. I'm going with Jaren Jackson here.
I think it is going to be Jaren Jackson. We do need to shout out Dylan Brooks, though. I think he
played better than I thought he'd be last year.
Yeah, he played in all 82 games last year. He shot 35.6% on 4 3-point attempts per 36 minutes. Not someone who's going to really be the engine of an offense ever, nor will he be put in that role. He had some freedom to attempt pull-up jumpers last year, but he shot under 30% on them. What's interesting to me, I think he can match up against some of the smaller OK wings in the league defensively, and having minutes with him and Kyle Anderson really helps the switchability of your defense, and Jaren Jackson in there as well. Another thing that he kind of brings, and maybe you don't need this now that you have Kyle Anderson, but it's worth mentioning, looking at how you lost Tyreke Evans. He can try and run some half-court pick and rolls. He wasn't great when doing that last year, but they really had him do it a bunch. And you just gain a feel for the game when you do that. And so if you have just this other person who's comfortable handing the ball, especially when you know that Mike Conley's battled injuries on and off over the past 3 years, Brooks also shot a respectable 48.4% on drives. I just like him, and I think he deserves a mention. They're still going to play him. He might even be their starting two at this point, I would hazard. Because you're not, is it Marshawn Brooks? Maybe Wayne Seldon, perhaps. But I like Dylan Brooks, and so we'll see how committed the Grizzlies are to developing while attempting to win once we look at just the minutes and the volume that are enjoyed by Brooks and Jaren Jackson Jr. They'll be good barometers for like where the Grizzlies are sort of leaning at this point. Player most likely to be traded.
I went with Marc Gasol. I don't know how much trade value he has, and maybe he rehabs it a little bit this season when he actually wants to play. He just seemed like he didn't care for big portions of last season, which is understandable when you're
a really good player. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, when you're a really good player and your team is actively trying to lose. And yeah, the whole David Fizdale thing was super weird. But he's on a – I don't want to say it's a pseudo-expiring because I don't see how he can turn down his $26 million option for next season. But maybe if he has a little bit of trade value and you think Jaren Jackson looks good enough to become – the guy at center right now, maybe you start entertaining that possibility, but I just don't know. I don't know how many teams around the league are going to be willing to take on his salary for the next 2 years. But if I had to pick one, I'm going to go with Marc Gasol.
My pick is Jamichael Green, expiring contract. And not that I like Jamichael Green. We know this. I saw someone gave him an NBA math crystal basketball ranking. Someone gave him a 1. And I know that someone, and I yelled at him.
yeah, that's too far.
Yeah, he's just this portable big. And there might be a team, now that you have Jaren Jackson Jr., you might just kind of view him as irrelevant. You're probably not going to re-sign him next summer. And there will be a team out there that could that's a big. We talk about the market for bigs. It's easier to me to find a home for Jermichael Green than it would be for Marc Gasol. And salary is a part of that, but also just in terms of function today. And if you just look, they have Temple, who was a good pickup for them, I thought, by the way, on his expiring contract. You have Wayne Selden, too, who's very interesting as a shooter and just like this bouncy guy off the dribble. They could build some interesting trade packages midseason if they find out that they're in the playoff hunt and they're looking just for an upgrade, and Temple and Green and Selden are all kind of playing these bit roles combined, and they want to look to swing for the fences. They could do something there. But I would go with just Jermichael Green, if only because Jaren Jackson Jr. has the chance to just play him, maybe not out of the rotation, but definitely out of a role that gives him even 15 minutes per game.
Yeah, I think that's all true. Can you hear my daughter yelling at our dog?
No, I cannot.
Okay, good.
Is she being nice to the dog? I love dogs. Tell her to stop being mean.
So her and Koji are best friends, but she loves trying to boss him around. It's pretty funny, actually.
Better him than you, I guess, right?
Oh, I trust me, I get it too.
Better defense or offense for this team? Why don't you ask your daughter?
yeah, she would be a good consultant on this. I'm going to go with defense for them. If Mike Conley and Marc Gasol are healthy, that's a great foundation for defense right there. And I think Jaren Jackson, we've both said it, is has the chance to be a really, really good defensive player too. So I think it's defense. And Kyle Anderson, we've already mentioned him, is one of the most important defensive players for the Spurs last season. So they've got a lot of good ingredients for defense.
I think it's going to be defense too, but I'm more cautious than I feel like I should be on it. Jaren Jackson Jr. is a rookie, and let's see how much they're going to play him first. And the more important thing to me is just that Marc Gasol is he still a really good defender? And the answer to me is, I'm going to say no. I'm going to say he's not a really valuable defender anymore. Sure. And just if you're asking him to move around at all on the defensive end, like it poses problems. Opponents last year shot 59.2% against him at the rim, which is not great. You look at the time that he spent defending pick and roll men, and he allowed 1.02 points per possession. That was in the 41st percentile. It's not going to get any easier in today's league to build a good defense with Marc Gasol as your center. Age 33 season. If you move him outside the paint with any of the contemporary bigs, he just doesn't have the pop to really get to closeouts. I don't know. He's not going to switch. He can do fine when he's dropping back and, you know, you're trying to ward off ball handlers that way. He's very smart, high IQ basketball player. Their defense is at risk of kind of surrendering ground to their offense, though, which might just be a testament to how good Mike Conley is offensively, what Kyle Anderson might be able to do for them, Dylan Brooks, Jaren Jackson Jr. himself, and Marc Gasol himself. I think it's going to be closer, though, than it would be in a typical year.
I think Marc Gasol can still be pretty good defensively if he's motivated. I think a huge part of his season last year was just the fact that he checked out.
I mean, that's fair. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but we're talking about a plotting 33-year-old big man.
Yeah, I was going to say there's certainly merit to your argument. There's plenty of reasons to think that he's going to be even slower next year. So yeah, I'm with you.
It's just if you're playing like he's someone I think that can get played off the floor. Where you look at Rudy Gobert and even Clint Capella to some extent, they're not going to get played off the floor by the Rockets who have Capella, but by the Warriors or by the Celtics or one of those teams, I think you can play Marc Gasol off the floor and do so with some semblance of ease.
Huh. Well, this is one that we have a slight difference of opinion on. I'm not as low on Gasol. I think he'll be.
Well, I didn't call him a piece of shit. I just don't. I don't think he can be the anchor of a top tier defense anymore. And if you believe, I believe their defense is going to be better, but it might have more to do with it. To me now, it has more to do with having Jaren Jackson Jr., a healthy Conley, and Kyle Anderson than it does Gasol.
That's fair. Let the record reflect that I did not say that.
That you, well, you basically made it come off that I thought Marc Gasol was a POS. So that's just had to clarify. Playoffs or not for the Grizzlies?
This is an easy, I think a pretty easy no. I'm not just going to say easy. And I think their ceiling is, I think this is another team that if they stay healthy could fight for like a 500 record, but that's just not going to be good enough in the West to get in.
I'm with you on that. I just, it's going to be, I'm at this like hedging point. It's going to be closer, I think, if they stay healthy. If it becomes clear that they're not going to make the playoffs and they veer towards tanking again, maybe they try and trade Conley or Gasol, but I don't really know what the markets for them would be. That's where they kind of fall out of the race completely. And I think they certainly deserve to be mentioned in that category with the Mavericks, the Suns. There are just going to be teams that pivot into this tank. They could be one of them. I was shocked to see that the Mavericks had better betting odds to win the Southwest than the Grizzlies. If they're healthy, Mike Conley and Marc Gasol alone feel like they're good for a 500 record. And that doesn't make them a playoff team, but I think that makes them a tough beat and just a quality squad in general. I don't think they'll make the playoffs, but I expect them to be better than the Mavericks. And that's not me to attack. I'm not trying to attack the Mavericks here. I do like Doncic, as we know. But the Grizzlies, I think we maybe sometimes forget, and I just crapped all over Marc Gasol, but I think we sometimes forget how valuable that core is. And now you add Anderson, not the cleanest fit, but we both really like Jaren Jackson Jr. I like Dylan Brooks. They have some interesting pieces on the team.
Yeah, I agree. I actually think that's kind of weird, too, that Dallas has better odds than the Grizzlies, because I think if the Grizzlies are healthy, they're a more likely 500 team than
I know
Dallas.
It speaks more to what the bettors are doing, but maybe it's also just a nod that they'll give up quicker than Dallas, which I also don't see, because it seems like they're trying to hang on longer than they should.
Yeah, and it could certainly all fall apart pretty quickly if Mike Conley gets hurt again. So
yeah.
All right, I think that wraps us up. We've hit all five Southwest teams.
In under 90 minutes, you're welcome.
Yeah. If you have anything to add, anything to complain about, hit us up on Twitter. As you know, Dan is at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor is at NBA underscore math. As always, leave us ratings, reviews. All that stuff is great. We sincerely appreciate it. Right now, you guys should go on and just leave reviews that say congratulations to Dan, because he's getting married this weekend. So shout out to him and his lovely fiance. Have fun with that, by the way. Until next time, we leave you with a shout out to Benno Udry and Kyle Anderson.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.